Good morning. How are you doing? The passage today is from Luke chapter 2, 22 to 40. It should be on the screen. It's good to have the Bazankis with us again, filling in the front row. It's been looking a bit empty without you. But with David back, everything looks fuller, just with him alone. Graham told the story last week of the church that got a new building and kind of dealt with the problem of the first row, but he didn't never quite finish. For those of you who weren't there, the start of the story went that there's a church in America and they needed a new building because the old one was leaking and falling down, and when the wind blew, the doors rattled, so they got an architect in to design a new building. And he interviewed everyone and said, what do you want from the new building? They said, well, we don't want the roof to fall in, and we don't want to leak it when it rains. We don't want the doors to rattle. And the pastor said, you know, there's another thing that's been bothering me is that whenever everyone comes and sits in, no one sits in the front row. They always kind of fill in from the back. And I've got these beautifully crafted sermons with 7 points, all starting with the same letter. And I'm fairly sure there's people sneaking away in the dark corners of the back just having a wee snooze. And we need to deal with this. I don't know if you can do anything about this. So the grand opening comes. The building's made. It looks wonderful. They come in. And everyone's curious to see whether the architects listened to what everyone said. And sure enough, the roof doesn't fall down. And the wind blows and the doors don't rattle. And they're like, is it going to leak? And it doesn't leak. But they look around and they go, there's only one row of seats. And they're right at the back. What's that about? But they sit down. And then as soon as that row's full, it slides forward. And another row pops up. And then they sit down on that. And then another row pops up. And then once everyone's sitting down, it all slides forward to the front of the church. And the pastor gets up to preach and thinks, this is great. They've really listened to me. The architect has got this just right. So everyone's down the front now. And the people in the congregation are going, well, this is all right. But did he listen to us? I'm not sure. Anyway, they didn't have to wait too long. Because just as the pastor was launching into point two of his sermon, a trapdoor opened and he disappeared. And the band got up and played and away they went. So yeah, I haven't got 7 points this morning, so hopefully you won't need a trapdoor. I'm not sure why Graham missed out that bit of the story, but anyway. Our passage, Luke 2, verses 22. And when the time came for their purification according to the law of Moses, they brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every male who first opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord. And they offered to offer a sacrifice according to what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of doves or two young pigeons. Now there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon, and this man was righteous and devout, looking forward to the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was upon him. And it had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. And he came in the Spirit into the temple when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him according to the custom of the law. He took him up in his arms and blessed God and said, Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation that you have prepared in the presence of all peoples. A light for revelation to the Gentiles, and for glory to your people Israel. And his father and his mother marveled at what was said about him. And Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, behold, this child is appointed for the fall and the rising of many in Israel, and for a sign that is opposed, and a sword will pierce through your own soul also, so that the thoughts from many hearts may be revealed. And there was a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was advanced in years, having lived with her husband 7 years from when she was a virgin, and then as a widow until she was 84. She did not depart from the temple, worshipping with fasting and prayer night and day. And coming up at that very hour, she began to give thanks to God and to speak of him to all who were waiting for the redemption of Jerusalem. And when they had performed everything according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee, to their own town of Nazareth. And the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom. And the favour of God was upon him. Does anyone still have any Christmas decorations up? I know the Bell family had a late start to the decoration season, but you've got them all ready. We have a slightly accidental tradition where in the weeks after Christmas we have to hunt for the decoration that we missed when we were tidying up. You know, we've just found our last two this week. There was a bauble hanging off of a light fitting somewhere, and there's a wee bit tinsel wrapped around one of the houseplants. So we finally got our last two pieces, and they go away into the loft later on. So this, in some ways, is our last Christmas passage from the lectionary. It kind of mirrors the kind of Advent period almost. And it comes at this time, as it's about 6 weeks after Christmas, and about which would have been about the time after Jesus' birth that Mary went up to the temple to do this. So this comes in Luke's Gospel immediately after the passage describing Jesus' birth, and comes before the passage about Jesus as a child going to the temple and then launches into his ministry. And it has another theme of waiting, which I think mirrors the Advent period quite nicely, with Simeon and Anna's long wait to see the Messiah, to see God's promise come to Israel. I wonder what's the longest you've waited for something, or what we're waiting for at the moment. I don't know if anyone's got anything that's going to on their mind. Stuart's waiting for a baby in a new house, both together. There's a wait for exams, exam results. Anyone else waiting for anything? Other things we might be waiting on are weddings coming up. Maybe folks have got holidays planned. We often seem to be waiting on parcels these days. Maybe waiting on operations, or waiting for an isolation period to end. Or maybe we're waiting on independent government reports to finally be published. So yeah, Mary would have waited about 40 days at this point for her isolation period to end, for the idea, for the kind of tradition that she was unclean to have passed, so that she could go out to the temple. And so they go up to the temple sacrifice for a couple of reasons. There was, from Moses, there was the understanding that the firstborn son of a family was consecrated to the Lord, almost as a form of kind of priesthood within the family. This had started on the evening that they left Egypt. So there's recognition of that they had to take their firstborn son up to the temple to present him. And then in Leviticus, they're told that when their child is born at the end of the isolation period for the mother, she is to offer two doves for purification. The rules actually said, for most people, they should offer a lamb and a dove. But there was an allowance made for those in poverty, if they couldn't afford a lamb, that they could just offer the two doves. So this kind of shows two of Luke's kind of key themes and the things he likes to draw out about Jesus. There's this kind of consecrated priestly role for him. And there's also the fact that he comes from a very poor background, a humble background. He's not born in splendor. He's not born in a palace. He's born in poverty to two poor parents. It's a kind of early model of Jesus' upside-down kingdom, where throughout his ministry, he blesses the poorest people. He seeks out the outcasts, the people looked down upon, the people who had no power, the ill, the sick, widows, orphans, the political outsiders, and blesses them. And he turns to the richest people in the society around him and points out how they're restricted or blinded by their possessions, how their care for their own belongings dulls their ability to see what God's doing and their ability to respond. Simeon is led to the temple and led to Jesus despite his humble appearance. And I wonder whether he was surprised to see the promised Messiah that he'd been promised that he would see. I wonder whether he was surprised to see him in the arms of a poor couple from way off in Galilee, one of the kind of out further away regions of the country. I don't know if that would have surprised him or whether it was what he was expecting to see. As a keen scholar and a devout man, maybe he had spotted God's kind of pattern throughout the Old Testament of choosing the outsiders, choosing the people rejected by others, and God's love of subverting our expectations, of choosing people and doing things in a way which doesn't seem like the human way of doing it. Simeon certainly had no problem with articulating what Jesus' purpose was on earth. To bring salvation for all people, to reveal God to the Gentiles, to us, and to fulfill God's promises to Israel. And he gave a very keen prophecy of what Jesus was to do, of the revolution he was to bring to Israel. The fall and the rise that he mentions is a reference to Isaiah, where there's mention of a stone to stumble on, and how it kind of causes many who think of themselves as righteous in Israel to fall and to miss what's going on. And the way that the fall of the old way of doing things and the rise of the new covenant and the new way of living with God. The sign spoken against is another reference to Isaiah, where the passage that we often hear read at Christmas, the Lord will give you a sign, the virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. So Jesus is that sign, and as he begins his ministry, we know that he is spoken against and argued against by many, many who should have recognized the sign. He also warns Mary of the personal heartbreak coming, of the fact that she is going to see her son die. And I wonder if this was the first hint that Mary had of what was to come, and what she must have made of that prophecy. It says that they marvel at what was said about him. At the end of this chapter in Luke, after it's talked about Jesus going to the temple as a child and being left behind, and Mary and Joseph having to search for him and find him, it talks about Mary treasuring these things in her heart and thinking about them, which I do wonder is maybe a kind of a clue as to where this story comes from, as to maybe it was passed down to the early community of Jesus' believers from people who had spoken to Mary about it. It's a pondering of mine. I don't know. But yeah, Mary and Joseph obviously knew that this baby was special and from God. But I wonder how much they knew about what he was going to do. Anna, of course, also recognizes Jesus. And she comes as another example of poverty, a widow who has lived most of her life without a husband, and at that time in that society would not have been well looked after. It's possible that she stays in the temple in part due to her devotion to God, but also because she had nowhere else to go and no other source of food. She's another exception to the corruption of the time. The temple, as we hear later in the Gospels, has been taken over by moneylenders and people selling things. And the chief priests are corrupt and more concerned with their standing with the Romans than with upholding God's laws. And here we have the poor widow who has to live in the temple as the great witness to God, as the person with the true insight of who she was seeing, and educating those around her of what it is. In some ways, Simeon and Anna represent the best of the Old Covenant. They represent Israelites doing what God has called them to do, of really dedicating themselves to him and standing up for his teaching, who can recognize it. And here they are representing the Old Covenant, meeting the embodiment of the new. It's like a handover moment from one one age to another. And they represent the longing of the faithful in the nation for the Messiah to come. That kind of ages-long wait for God's promise to come to earth. How does it feel when we're waiting? Karis, how are you feeling about the wait for exam results? Nervous? Stu, how's your waiting going? Excited as well. Anyone else? Maybe it's frustrating. We can kind of feel powerless, like we're stuck, not able to do anything. Can feel never ending. Can be anxious about what's to come. And doubtful about whether it is actually coming. But waiting, as Stuart said, can also be exciting. Because you know something is coming and something is about to change. And whilst it can make us feel powerless, it can also highlight to us how dependent we are on whatever we're waiting for. That we're in that period where it's not up to us what happens next, but we're waiting for it to come. And while sometimes waiting can feel never-ending, there is that promise that something is coming. As if we didn't think there was something there, we wouldn't wait, we'd go off and do something else. If you're sat at the bus stop, you must believe that there's a bus coming, because if you didn't think there was a bus coming, you'd get up and phone a taxi. And whilst we can be anxious, it can also be an opportunity to be trusting. You trust in the bus timetable, you hope that it's accurate. It can be a time to maybe put your anxiety of, is the thing I'm waiting for actually going to happen, to one side, because you know it's going to happen and that's why you're waiting. And whilst doubts do come up whilst we're waiting, it's that opportunity to be faithful. I've just recently got a new dog, as many of you know, and there's a contrast between what Ailsa, the new dog, and Benji, the old dog, do when I've got a treat in my hand. As Benji will sit, and then he'll lie, and then he'll weave around my legs, and he'll run through his little catalogue of tricks, waiting to see what it is he needs to do to get his treat, and then eventually he'll just sit and look at you with his bright eyes and wagging tail and go, come on, come on, come on, what are we doing? Ailsa, if I stand in front of her for a treat, she'll try sitting, she'll try lying, and then after that, if there's no treat, she'll jump, and she'll try and paw the treat out of my hand and try and kind of run around me and try and bite it out of my hand. We're trying to teach her patience, but at the moment, she doesn't quite have the trust that the treat's going to come anyway. Benji's done enough tricks and games with us that he knows that eventually he's going to get the treat if he just kind of sits there for long enough. Whereas Ailsa is always thinking, maybe I should just grab it, I don't know if I'm getting it. Maybe I should just go for it. If we're making food in the kitchen, now, with Benji, he goes and sits on the mat because he knows that's where he gets treats. With Ailsa, you're constantly kind of body checking her kind of side to side as she tries to kind of leap up the side to help herself. And if you imagine a dog, a sheepdog waiting for its next instruction, when it's in that kind of down position and its eyes are on the sheep or it's on its owner, flicking back and forth going, when am I going, when am I going, when am I going? Versus a dog behind a fence just kind of lunging and jumping and snarling and trying to get out because it doesn't know if it's getting to go or not. And it's desperate that you've forgotten about it and it needs to go. We need to wait like the dog that knows that something's coming. Like the dog that trusts its owner. That it doesn't need to run out and grab it itself because it's going to get something later. And we also need to wait as servants. When Simeon starts his speech where he says, Lord, now you're letting your servant depart, the words used there have a strong implication of a kind of a master, as in master and slave. It's a recognition that God is in charge. In the past, we've had the term the kind of lady-in-waiting or man-in-waiting for a king, and we still talk about waiters in restaurants today, where they're not waiting because they're impatient or because they don't know what to do. They're waiting until the person they're looking after needs something. We can trust in God's control. When we look around the world around us, it is in chaos. And there's more going wrong than any of us can fix. You hear of people despairing, particularly young folks despairing of the world when they look at the climate crisis and how little has been done and how much needs to be done. And we have the rumours of war, and the war is actually happening, and how can anyone stop it? But we can trust that God is in control. What we need to do is do what we can, and that on its own is not enough, but we trust God to do the rest. We can't change everything, but if we change the things we can do, we can rely on God to change the other things. We are, of course, human, so we're going to stumble on the stone, we're going to fall, we are going to feel frustrated and powerless and doubtful, and wonder if the end is ever coming. But we need to learn to lean into God's promises. The promise that Simeon had was a remarkable one, that he was going to see the Messiah. He would not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. So we need to remember what the promises are that have been made to us. You may have personal promises that God has made to you. You may find them in the scriptures, the promises that God has made to all of us. Susan, long ago, was given a promise. It was something that a few folks had kind of prayed over her about, and it didn't really make sense at the time, but it was a promise that, which passage was it? I think it was one of Jesus' parables where he talks about how the birds never worry for what they're going to eat the next day. And at the time, it was nice, but it didn't make a huge amount of sense to her, and she wasn't quite sure, but she kind of, it kind of came up a few times, so she remembered it, and then kind of years later, she was just starting her career as a freelancer, and there were points where she had a fiver to put in the fuel tank to get to the next job. And that was the point at which she remembered the promise that she would always be looked after and always have enough. And she always had that fiver to get her to the next job. She never kind of failed to buy dinner or get enough fuel to get to work. There's a few points in the Old Testament where Israelites set up stones or build altars as a mark of remembrance. They set up something physical to remind them. As a landscaper, I'm quite keen on the idea of us all setting up standing stones in our back gardens as things to remember. Maybe if you're someone that likes a bit of craft and kind of hands-on things and your reflections, you could grab some stones and paint them with some of the promises that God has fulfilled for you as a physical reminder. Or like Lillian was saying in her prayer earlier about the snowdrops coming up, there's often these seasonal changes which remind us of what's come before, and the snowdrop's a great one for kind of seeing life appearing, the first life of spring appearing out the ground again. So look for the promises. Search through the scriptures for the promises God has made you that he has already fulfilled. And remember the fulfilled promises as you look to the promises that are still coming. Lord God, I pray that you can keep us faithful, that you can remind us of what you have done, that we can focus on you as we look for our next steps, and that we can keep our eyes fixed on your promises to come. In your name, amen.